evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, we're continuing our conversation, is Kenneth Catania. He is the Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University, and we're continuing our conversation about his book, Great Adaptations, Star-Nosed Moles, Electric Eels, and Other Tales of Evolution's Mysteries Solved. Kenneth, welcome back to the show. It's such a pleasure to be talking to you about this book.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
When I finished this book, one of the things I started thinking about is as a kid, you start learning, well, there are five senses, you know, touch, taste, and so on and so forth. And then you read your book and it's like, there's a wonderful, wide, wacky world of the way creatures are sensing the world. It's amazing.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of my favorites that I learned about in the course of my early studies was detecting electric fields.
Yes.
You know, that's one you might never really think of, but they're...
Is there a name for that sense?
Absolutely. It's called electroreception, and it sort of comes in two different flavors, you might say. There's the kind where you detect things that are out in the environment, the way if we were listening to things, you'd hear a sound out in the environment. And then there's a kind where you generate your own electric field and probe with that electric field like a radar system. And I like to use the analogy that that's kind of like a bat using echolocation.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, there's two ways to use electricity. There's two ways to sort of use sound, to listen to things or to use sound to probe. And the same is true for electricity.
Have mammals as a group just sort of lost a lot of these or never evolved? These kinds of sense. I mean, are there mammals that use electro?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that because there is one mammal there's pretty good support that the duck-billed platypus is a crazy creature anyway. So maybe you should think of that's the one that's going to have the weird sense. But the bill of the duck-billed platypus has electroreceptors on it. And it's a sense that really mostly almost certainly requires water to use.
And they're aquatic, so
they're aquatic, so it makes some sense that they would do that.
So why am I not surprised about the duck-billed platypus, which is like a monotreme to begin with, so it's laying eggs. It's got poison spurs on its feet, and then of course it'll have electroreceptors.
Yeah, it's such a crazy creature. I love them.
And I was just reading an article, they found out that their fur fluoresces.
Oh, I hadn't seen that.
Oh yeah, they under black light or whatever kind of light they were using, they glow blue and all this other stuff. So, duck-billed platypus.
Yeah.
Now, you have worked with some of like my favorite animals in the world. These are creatures that as a kid I dreamt about. Last time we talked about star-nosed moles, which to date I still have yet to see. A live one. You've worked with water shrews, which I'm fascinated about. But you worked with a snake, which I bet most people have never heard of, the tentacled snake. Talk to me first about where it's found.
Yeah, so that is in Southeast Asia, in Cambodia, Vietnam area. It's probably relative to all the aquatic snakes that are there. It's not all that common. In fact, you might call it a rare predator. That's a term that Dawkins has used to describe creatures that can do really, really sneaky things and always get away with it.
That's because if everybody else did it, there would be some evolution of behavior on their prey to avoid it.
Exactly. It's like con artist, you know, once you get all those emails saying, you know, to send money to a Nigerian prince, you're like, I know that one.
Now, the weird thing is you were led to them by looking at alligator snappers. Which is one of my favorite reptiles.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite reptiles as well. Though I never really was studying them so much as when I worked at the zoo, there was an alligator snapping turtle in the reptile house. And because I was enamored with that creature as a kid, I used to go look at the alligator snapping turtle periodically. And then on one of my visits, the National Zoo had acquired tentacled snakes. And I walked around the corner, saw this aquarium with them, and I was like, whoa. What the heck is going on with that snake? It was like the star-nosed mole of snakes.
It is.
So you can see why I was immediately enamored.
Well, let's describe it, because they have these two weird fleshy wide barbels that are scale covered, coming off of either side of their mouth.
Yeah. So one thing that's interesting about them is they are totally aquatic. They never come out of the water. They give live birth in the water. So they're even though they're a freshwater species, they're probably as aquatic as a sea snake. The other thing, they're small and innocuous, so they're not scary. If you pick one up, it tries to disguise itself as a stick and just sit there, you know, totally still, won't try to bite you. And then they have these little tentacles that come off the side of the parabem, that come off the sides of the front of the face. And as you said, they're covered with scales. And so, you know, the initial question is, what the heck are those tentacles for?
Now, one of the interesting things about this chapter is that very clearly, as do all, I think all your chapters do, but especially in this chapter, the way science works, you start out with an idea, you test it, and then you're led other places. So you have these tentacles. So the first thing you think is you start to dissect them. What do you find out?
Well, it turns out the first thing that we did was to we basically wanted to fluorescently label the nerve endings. And that's exactly what we did. And, you know, the first question would be, well, okay, maybe this is a sensory structure. And, of course, if it's a sensory structure, it has to be supplied with nerve endings. And often you can get, you know, we talked about the star-nosed mole and the incredible density of nerves in those appendages. So, for example, if these were just for camouflage, you wouldn't expect them to have a ton of nerve endings in them. But what we found was they were very densely innervated. And then you can ask the question, do you get any clues from the way that they're innervated?
Right. It was an unusual arrangement.
Yeah. If you were going to look at something that made contact with stuff for touch, for example, you'd probably expect to see the nerve endings near the surface of the cuticle or the epidermis or skin or whatever kind of covering you have. And these, unlike typical touch nerve endings, sort of cross the middle of the tentacle like little guy wires under tension. And actually, that was sort of the perfect configuration for what we suspected they might be used for, which is to detect water movements. So unlike something that would detect like your fingertip touch, these nerve endings were arranged perfectly for detecting whether the tentacles themselves shifted in the water.
So that's like an ultra-sensitive whisker. I think that's how you described it in the book.
Yeah, exactly. And so they are used to detect water movements, and they aid the tentacled snake in its sole mission in life, which is to catch fish. So the tentacled snake is a master fisher, and it's sometimes called the fishing snake. And all it does is essentially eat fish and, of course, make small tentacle snakes.
but the story doesn't stop there, which is what I love about these essays in this book. You found out, you know, as you're filming these, that they're expert marksmen, but actually they're almost like too good to be true.
Yeah, so the thing that's amazing about this is just, you know, I'm excited about the fact that these tentacles are kind of interesting, but they pale in comparison to something totally unrelated that we discovered by happenstance, which is this is the sneakiest, most deceptive predator that I think ever encountered. It's just, it's got the ultimate attack.
Well, let's describe what you see when you look at a film of it, catching the fish. It seems like the fish lends a hand to being eaten.
Yeah, yeah. So I love it. So I got to tell you about a clue to this. So I read this earlier book by a guy named John Murphy, who studied this whole group of snakes, and he filmed them without using slow motion as they attack fish. And he pointed out sometimes the fish disappears within a single frame. Like it just disappears when the snake strikes. And, you know, how could that possibly be? Well, it turns out, I should tell you that tentacled snakes have this really interesting hunting posture. They sit there really still in a J shape with their head forming sort of the bottom of the J, and they just wait really patiently for a fish to come to just the right place. The fish can go all around their head, and it won't strike until the fish is in just the right place. And then they strike, and the fish often swims straight into the snake's mouth.
I know. When I read that sounded so bizarre. Well, you actually go, had the snake hacked the fish's brain? It's like,
right.
It's like, so this is where we have to now look at the fish. What's the
exactly,
what you call the sea start escape response? What is that?
Yeah, so this is the beautiful thing about this trap and this story. We know a huge amount. So the fish escape response, fish, well, you know, I back up and say, well, we all know fish are prey to just about everything. you know, everybody eats fish. We eat fish. Snakes eat fish. Other fish eat fish. So fish have evolved for hundreds of millions of years, this incredibly efficient escape response. It is very fast. It's triggered by these two giant brain cells called Mauthner cells. And it's either to the left or to the right, because fish, you know, that based on their body plan, they don't have a lot of options for how to execute this. But as would make sense, they go away from the striking predator, and they do this using sound. So that's another surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that fish can hear.
Yeah, fish have very sensitive ears, and one of the most important things a fish ear is for is detecting the sound of an attack. And that sound of the attack gets to them super fast because sound and water travels very quickly, 1,500 meters per second. So it's almost immediately the ear gets this information as soon as any predator tries to attack them and triggers this cascade of fast neural signals that will shoot the fish away in the opposite direction. It's almost like they're, you know, you can see this in a pet store or in your aquarium if you tap the glass.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like the fish teleports to the side. I'm like, how did that happen? And essentially, that will get them away from most predators very quickly, even diving birds and so forth. But if you're the tentacle snake, you can turn this to your advantage, sort of no pun intended, by essentially waiting for the fish to come to just the right spot. And what the snake does is it moves a part of its neck on the opposite side from its head first. And this generates a sound in the water. And it triggers this super fast neural response. And a lot of people call the cells that trigger this command neurons because it's not like the fish can override this behavior.
Once this
automated escape gets triggered, it just goes through the entire sequence of events to turn away from the attack. It's like if you pulled your hand away from a hot stove before you even know what happened. The fish is doing the same thing. It's like, I'm going to die if I don't get out of here, so says the Mauthner cell. And it triggers this escape response. And within literally a fraction of a second, it's propelled away from the attack. But in this case, it's propelled towards the attack, because what the snake has done is set this trap up so that when it moves its neck, the fish turns towards the snake's head, and then the snake begins to strike, and it's often swims straight into the snake's mouth. It's incredible to see in slow motion.
Now, one of the things you talk about in the book, and we had alluded to this earlier, is if a lot of other snakes that were in the water there were doing the same thing, chances are fish would have evolved into not responding to it, a different response. But because it's an uncommon predator, the fish doesn't know.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Its body doesn't know.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, if you're going to run into 100 predators and the best thing to do 99 times out of 100 is turn away from them as fast as you can, then it's only the really unlucky fish that end up running into a tentacled snake and going the wrong direction. And the fish as a sort of group or any given species as a population is never going to evolve a defense. So the snake is sort of tapped into this sort of niche where it can be rare enough to keep you, it can keep using the same con, so to speak, the same scam on the fish, and make its living that way by tricking the fish to turn in the wrong direction. But actually, it gets better than that. So there's a position in which if the fish is swimming straight towards the snake instead of sort of to the side of the snake, then the tentacled snake has this problem where the snake is either going to move to the left or the right of the strike. And that would leave it basically unpredictable where the fish is going to be by the time that the snake's head gets there. So to make a long story short, what the tentacled snake does in those situations is trigger an escape response in one direction and then aim for the future position of the fish.
Whoa!
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's predicting. It's a predictive strike.
it's a predictive strike. It's kind of like if you were playing baseball and
you had
the pitcher was winding up to throw a pitch and you decided, I know where the pitch is going before the pitch is thrown. So you can start to swing.
Wow.
And then,
wow,
then the pitcher throws the ball and you get a home run. It's a done deal before the pitcher even throws anything.
Are there any other creatures, animals, vertebrates that utilize this kind of thing where they trick the prey's instinctual behavior or essentially plays into it and then are able to capture it by doing sort of
there are. Yeah. There's quite a number. There's some birds that will basically go around sort of flushing prey with their wings and causing them to escape, and then they're visual predators, so they'll fly after the prey and basically catch them. So they want the prey to try to run. It's like, don't run is your worst thing. But there's an amazing one, and I'm not sure if you're thinking about this earthworm.
Let's stop right there. Are the tentacle snakes, are this is obviously instinctual and they're born knowing this, correct? They're knowing how to do this.
Well, that was one of the big questions that I had. And I, before that, so when you see this in an adult tentacle snake, there's two options for how this could have come about. And they're both logical possibilities. And one is, a tentacle snake that only eats fish has eaten hundreds and hundreds of fish. So it could have learned this trick. Or it could be born with it, and with this ability. And frankly, I would have put my money on the learning side, because it seems incredible that you could be born with the ability to predict the future movements of your prey. I mean, that would,
in a snake. We're talking about in a snake,
yeah,
too. Yeah,
exactly. And so, I talk about this in the book. So it basically went on this quest to get newborn tentacle snakes. And so here it becomes an experimental challenge. You need tentacle snakes that have never seen a fish to be 100% sure that you've eliminated the possibility of learning. And so you sort of wait and you've set up this romantic aquarium environment with tentacled snakes and candles and nice music playing. And, well, you hope that eventually you get some newborn tentacled snakes. And after much waiting, we did. And so I set up these experiments. And sure enough, I was blown away to see that the tentacled snakes are born with the ability to predict the future movements of fish. It's essentially sort of written into the code of their DNA, so to speak, which, eventually to the brain. And so that's it's an amazing testament to this. It's an arms race, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
The tentacled snakes are ahead of the fish escape response.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Kenneth Catania. He is the Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University, and we're continuing our conversation about his book, Great Adaptations, Star-Nosed Moles, Electric Eels, and Other Tales of Evolution's Mystery Solved. One of the weirdest chapters, because it's just, I can sort of picture you in this, is about something called worm grunting. And
yeah,
did you know about this before you got involved in it? Is this because it only happens in a few parts in the United States?
Yeah, I had heard about it, and it was on sort of my to-do list to one day check this thing out, because I love mysteries, and this was like an insane mystery.
It's a big deal where it happens in the South, because there's like a worm grunting festival. There's a Miss Worm grunting for that year. But talk about what it is.
So worm grunting is a bait collecting technique. And it's been handed down for generations in the Southeast. And it's pretty prominent in the panhandle of Florida. And where I eventually went, and where the annual worm grunting festival is held, is in a place called Sopchoppy, Florida. which is pretty close to the Apalachicola National Forest. And so, you know, what a great place to do field work. It's a really interesting ecosystem. It's full of reptiles and alligators and interesting animals, and it's just a beautiful place as well. And so eventually I decided I got to go down there and check it out. And one of the great things about going down there is there are two sort of really well-known worm grunters, Gary and Audrey Rebel, just wonderful people who make a living collecting bait and have kind of kept alive this tradition. Because I should say it's not done anywhere near as much as it used to be done in the past. And there's a little story there. So Charles Kuralt, who used to do this on the road series, went down to cover worm grunting. And it turned out lots of people were making a lot of money doing this. And the IRS apparently didn't know about it. And once Charles Kuralt covered it, they sort of came in and checked out what was going on. And then the National Forest Service got worried about the worms and they permitted it. So I think Charles Kuralt was not very popular with the worm grunters, actually.
But what is it?
So what you do, good point, yeah, what is it? So what you do if you're a worm gruncher is you kind of look like you're going on a vampire hunt. So you take a big wooden stake and a piece of metal, usually a spring steel from a car, you go out into the woods and you pound the stake into the ground, and then you take the metal, what's sometimes called traditionally a rooping iron, and you rub it over the top of the wooden stake. And that, if you do it right, it's kind of like you have to learn this because it's kind of like playing a special musical instrument.
Do you hear it? Do you hear something?
Oh, yeah. You'll absolutely hear it. It sounds, it'll be the biologist in me, but it sounds like the mating call of a large alligator.
Oh, okay. So like I know that call.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a low frequency, a vibrating sort of sound that resonates for quite some distance.
And what happens?
So the ground vibrates, and then incredibly, hundreds of large earthworms come to the surface.
What was your reaction when you actually saw this?
Well, I was delighted because it's one of those things where when you hear about it and you read about it, you think this can't be as good as the stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's just wonderful to go down and see something that is better than the stories that you hear. And so just to see that happen is really astounding. And, of course, in retrospect, I knew kind of it had to be true because you couldn't make a living collecting bait unless it worked, right? You know, you there's people that are doing this and making a living doing it, so it had to work. But to see it is something else.
Now, I should mention, and you talk about this in the book, this only happens in that area because it seems like it's certain soils and certain species of earthworms.
That seems to be true. Though, I mean, it is actually done in a lot of places in the Southeast.
But has anybody in the north tried to do it?
I don't know.
Oh my God. Now I have a project for next spring.
Yeah. I don't know of a successful worm grunting venture in the north, so I would guess not. I would think people would be doing it if it worked. Huh. I like your line of questioning because now we get to the biological explanation. Why does it work? And that might explain why it's not done too much further north. And the reason it seems to work, well, I should get to the punchline. Or before I tell you that, I got to tell you that
Let me tell you, we only have 2 minutes left, so you don't have to give the punchline because people need to buy your book. So
I could leave them hanging on.
Well, so has anybody tried it, say, for instance, in the Northeast and not have it worked?
I don't know. Nobody's reported to me back whether it works. But I'll just say all of this is caused because there's a predator involved.
And it's mimicking the predator.
Yes.
But okay, there's so many questions I had while I was reading this chapter. The evolution of the human behavior. How does a person, like, learn to worm grunt? Like, who was the first worm grunter? Like,
I've thought about this, and I think the most obvious way is by cutting down saplings you would essentially, and people have actually said that that's a form of worm grunting. It's not very efficient because you have to cut down a tree every time.
Yeah.
But if you were cutting down a sapling, you're going to generate these vibrations in the soil. And so I'm just guessing, but I'm imagining that, you know, sort of homesteaders down there who were going to need fishing bait, if you cut down trees and hundreds of worms came out of the ground, you'd probably remember it.
Did you try your hand at worm grunting?
I did, and I managed to get reasonably good at it. It was delightful to do that. I had a worm grunting permit and everything.
Back up. Beep. So you now need a permit to worm grunt.
Yeah. Need a worm grunting permit.
And people, and you know, you talked about the, you know, fish and wildlife. People have got to realize that worms are an important part of the ecosystem. Wipe out several hundred at a shot is sort of.
Yeah.
Has it seemed to have an effect on the?
You know, it's pretty hard to tell. I would bet that it has an effect locally, but the Apalachicola Forest is a big place, you can only do this in the accessible areas. Often they'll do this where there's recently been a burn.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of places where they're not going to be able to collect the worms. That's sort of my quick overview from what I saw when I was down there.
Now, you do solve the problem or the question of why the worms are running for hell to the above ground. And people will need to read the book in order to find that out. But that was fascinating. And it involves another creature that I'm always fascinated, that I have seen alive. And that's all I'll say about that. We're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight is Kenneth Catania. He is the Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University. And we're continuing our conversation about his vastly entertaining and fascinating book, Great Adaptations, Star-Nosed Moles, Electric Eels, and Other Tales of Evolution's Mysteries Solved. Ken, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks. It's been great to be here.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.